President Rouhani says that the Iranian nation's resistance will force the next U.S. administration to return to its commitments and remove the sanctions. Britain says a no-deal scenario is still the most likely outcome for the post-Brexit trade deal with the European Union. French President Emmanuel Macron tests positive for COVID-19, sending himself and at least two European leaders and several top French officials into self-isolation. And welcome to World News here in the Iranian capital. I'm your host, Behzad Zajafir. Good to have you with us. Starting with Iran, the president is saying that Iranian nation's resistance will ultimately make the U.S. respect their rights. Hassan Rouhani says that he has no doubt that such a resistance will force the next U.S. administration to return to its commitments and remove anti-Tehran sanctions. The president stressed the leader's remarks on Wednesday that Tehran should also focus its attempts on neutralizing the sanctions in the first place. Rouhani was virtually addressing an inauguration ceremony of a series of national projects. He hailed the unveiling of the project across the nation during the coronavirus pandemic and despite what he called an economic war imposed on the nation. Political commentator Danny Shaw believes that Washington will ultimately change course with Tehran as it is unable to isolate countries like Iran and Venezuela.
Politics is very dynamic. The ruling class is quick on its feet, and they will work through Biden according to their assessment of the best way to achieve their strategic, geopolitical, and economic objectives. At this point, we can only speculate, but Iran, thanks to China, which has 17% of the world's GDP, of the world's production, and thanks to deals with other isolated sanctions, blockaded countries like Venezuela, the U.S. is realizing that they cannot isolate and blockade these countries, because you now have massive trading blocks with the BRICS nations, Russia, China, the other countries under siege by the U.S. So if Iran can continue to circumvent these sanctions, and the sanctions are completely unsuccessful, this massive economic war, then I think the U.S. will change course.
Now, Hanoi has criticized the U.S. sanctions on a Vietnamese company over trade with Tehran, saying that Washington's decision is regrettable. The Vietnamese foreign ministry said that trade relations between Tehran and Hanoi are strictly civilian and only involve transaction of essential goods. On Wednesday, the U.S. Treasury Department announced sanctions on a number of global firms, including Vietnam Gas and Chemicals Transportation Corporation. Washington says that the enterprise was involved in significant transactions for the transport of petroleum products from Iran. President Trump has intensified his so-called maximum pressure campaign against Iran as his term is drawing to a close. Iran has long slammed U.S. sanctions as economic terrorism. The United Nations General Assembly has overwhelmingly adopted a draft resolution in support of Palestinian self-determination. Now, to discuss that further, we're joined by our guests in our news review program a short while ago.
On this news review, the United Nations General Assembly has overwhelmingly adopted a draft resolution in support of Palestinian self-determination.
The result of the vote is as follows: in favor 168, against 5, abstentions 10. Draft resolution 2 is adopted.
Meanwhile, Palestinian Foreign Minister Riyad al-Maliki expressed his gratitude to the countries that voted in favor of the document. He called on the international community to find mechanisms to implement its obligations and resolutions to safeguard the rights of all people, in the interest of maintaining international peace and security. The top diplomat also called on UN member states to fulfill their responsibility to protect the inalienable rights of the Palestinian people. He further called on them to take practical measures against the Israeli occupation and those rogue states that further encourage Tel Aviv to commit crimes. Well, joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have head of the Stop the Wall campaign, Mr. Jamal Joma, joining us from Ramallah, also from the Palestine Solidarity Campaign, Mr. Mick Napier is with us from Edinburgh. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Jamal Juma in Ramallah. Mr. Juma, give us your thoughts on the UNGA draft resolution with regards to Palestine self-determination.
Yeah, this is in the amid of the American administration policy to liquidate Palestine issue in the last 4 years since 2017 when Trump came to the power. It proves that still Palestine and Palestinian issue is alive, and it's still a very important issue and have a majority support international wide that we have to build on. The problem of the such a resolution is two things. First of all, that there is no mechanism where the international community can fulfill fulfill their commitments and implement this decision. The other thing, I think there is a lack of follow-up from the Palestinian authority in this context. And as Palestinian movements observing this issue since the ICJ decision, I think it's still taking into consideration the international power, the relation of the authority with Israel, with the United States, with the West. So we have to leave this place, and we have to start the fight widely, internationally, for the implementation of such a resolutions, for the human implementation of the human rights on the Palestinian case.
Mr. Napier in Edinburgh, I'd like to get your opinion on the issue as well. We know that whatever is passed by the United Nations General Assembly is non-binding, but surely symbolically, this does mean a lot.
The numbers are very dramatic. When I heard the news, I didn't expect them to appear in quite this stark relationship. 168 for the Palestinian right to self-determination, which brings the great majority of world opinion diametrically opposed to Netanyahu and the Israeli government's legal or illegal for the Israeli state, but denial of Palestinian rights to self-determination in Palestine, because the nation state law stated that only Jews have this democratic right across the entire land surface of Palestine. So it's a collision, a public collision between world public opinion, which we already knew by every measure was hostile, critical, or very suspicious of what Israel was doing, as distinct from elite opinions and governments, but it brings this into very stark relief indeed. So those of us, people of goodwill around the world, campaigning for Palestinian rights, human and national, against the Israeli regime, will be able to approach the middle ground, will be able to approach trade unions, to approach churches, to say, look at this vote, and this is completely in opposition to the position of the Israeli government. But Jamal makes an extremely key point. I was just doing a bit of reading in the last few days. Not just the General Assembly, but sometimes even the Security Council denounces Israel. I mean, Israel introduced hijacking into the Middle East. It was denounced by the UN Security Council. Today just happens to be the anniversary of Israel pushing over 400 people across the border into Lebanon, or trying to do so, denounced by the USA, denounced by the Security Council, but no mechanism. And Israel knows that this is a cynical game, where the EU, for example, is always to the fore, denouncing Israel's behavior, but fighting tooth and nail against those who would like to give teeth to it. So yes, the moral high ground, it's not the moral high ground. It's very clearly on the side of the Palestinians, who are the victims of atrocious crimes and continue to resist. The danger is that now that Morocco has brought 50 or 60 years of hidden alliance with Israel out into the open, the UAE and so on, this may give the Israelis the confidence to escalate their crimes. The massive ethnic cleansing of 48, the massive ethnic cleansing of 67, maybe they are even entertaining the hopes of another one. So yes, it's good news because it shows the isolation of the Israeli regime, but it also needs to, it needs to be recognized, as your other guest has said, there is no mechanism for punishing Israel. That will come down to an enraged world public opinion.
Thank you, gentlemen. Jamal joining us from Ramallah. Also, thanks to Mick Napier speaking to us from Edinburgh. And with that, it brings us to an end here on this edition of the News Review. Just stay tuned, though. There's plenty more to come here on the
Now, moving out of the rest of this broadcast, Israeli forces have attacked a Palestinian school in a village near the West Bank city of Jenin. The troops fired tear gas grenades inside the school, causing injuries and panic among the pupils. That also disrupted classes while teachers rushed to treat the students for gas inhalation. Palestinian authorities have condemned the attack, calling for Israel to be held accountable for its crimes against Palestinian people, including minors. They say the Tel Aviv's attacks on educational facilities constitute a grave violation of children's rights to education and development. The UK is striking a pessimistic tone by saying that a no-deal scenario is still the most likely outcome of Brexit talks with the EU. A spokesman for the UK Prime Minister made that comment. He, however, said that negotiators from both sides are working to bridge the remaining gaps. EU negotiator Michel Barnier noted that it would be difficult but possible to reach a post-Brexit trade deal with the UK by Friday. Political groups in the European Parliament also said that they have to receive the text of a deal by Sunday, and they warned that otherwise they would not be able to ratify a deal before Britain leaves the EU's single market on December the 31st. Staying with the Europe, French President Emmanuel Macron has tested positive for COVID-19. His office says a diagnosis was made following a PCR test at the onset of the first symptoms. The president would isolate himself for the next 7 days and continue to run the country remotely. His wife is also self-isolating but has no symptoms. Now, following that announcement, French Prime Minister, European Council President, Spanish Prime Minister, and also the Portuguese Prime Minister said that they will also self-isolate for precaution because they had close contact with the French president. The United Kingdom is reviewing its decision to give the nation a five-day break from COVID-19 restriction, and there has been a surge in infections and a new strain of the virus detected since that decision was made. Bianca Rahimi has more.
In the UK, up to three families will be allowed to form a bubble under one roof over the festive period. That's less than a week away, and amid a surge in infections, London and nearby areas have entered Tier 3, the highest level of local restrictions in England. A UK cabinet minister has urged Britons to use their personal judgment on whether to meet under relaxed coronavirus measures over Christmas.
And my view is that the government can set a legal framework, and then it's for people to use their good judgment. You can't legislate for every eventuality, particularly something as sensitive as Christmas, where people will come to different judgments based on the vulnerability of their own family and how important this is to them.
Across Europe, governments have warned of a spike in infections if Christmas gatherings go ahead as normal. In Germany, restrictions have been tightened and all businesses selling non-essential goods have closed. Over Christmas, only five people from two households will be allowed to meet, not including children under 14.
Ladies and gentlemen, the situation is more serious than it has ever been in this pandemic. The total number of cases is higher than ever, and it continues to rise. There is a danger that the situation will continue to worsen, making it more and more difficult to deal with the pandemic and its consequences.
Italy and the Netherlands also plan tighter lockdowns over the holiday period. Meanwhile, all eyes are on the European Medicine Agency, which has been under pressure to approve the Pfizer vaccine.
It is good news that approval can be granted on 23rd December, as things stand today, that is, if the data which is now being processed further becomes available. We can be optimistic that approval can be granted on 23rd December, which is good news for the entire European Union.
The UK was the first country in the world to authorise emergency use of the vaccine. In the first week, 137,000 people have been vaccinated. The number is expected to increase as GP surgeries are given supplies of the jab and care homes will follow. With a record economic slump brought on by the pandemic, the UK is hoping an attempt to spread holiday cheer does not backfire spectacularly. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Eurozone finance ministers say that a successful rollout of COVID-19 vaccine is imperative to saving the EU's economy. The pandemic is fueling an economic slump in the 27-nation bloc, resulting in rising levels of poverty. Jerome Hughes has the story.
Thousands of businesses across the EU have closed their doors permanently due to the impact of COVID-19. In some of the bloc's countries, cafes, restaurants and hairdressers, like here in Belgium, remain in lockdown. Hundreds of thousands of young people who have precarious employment contracts are losing their jobs. Eurozone finance ministers, known as the Eurogroup, have just concluded their final meeting of 2020. They are pinning all their hopes on effective vaccines.
If vaccines are made available to all Europeans over the course of 2021, we could see a swifter than expected return of GDP to its pre-pandemic levels.
Never before has there been so much economic uncertainty in the EU.
It's a serious source of concern, and we also see that there is very little progress made on poverty and social exclusion, which remains at a very high level in the EU.
Faltering trade negotiations between the EU and UK are compounding the problem.
We hope that a successful agreement is possible, but of course we want the right agreement and an agreement that is durable.
Even those who have kept their jobs are feeling the pinch. So-called in-work poverty is increasing in the EU. The European Trade Union Confederation says a quarter of EU member states are providing little or no support for those who are self-employed. This is a particular problem in Bulgaria, Croatia, Cyprus, Germany, Hungary, Italy and Spain. Despite COVID-19 and Brexit, Eurozone finance ministers are expressing optimism. Business groups, though, are forecasting long-term economic challenges for the EU.
That is because of structural problems, most experts agree. For example, there is still criticism that education systems do not meet the needs of employers. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The United States sets a grim double record in terms of new COVID-19 cases and fatalities. Some 3,700 people died and 250,000 cases were reported in just one day. The U.S. has seen a marked spike in its infections for more than a month. And that's while 113,000 people are hospitalized due to the virus. The overall death toll stands at more than 307,000, the total number of infections at nearly 17 million. The U.S. has started vaccinating healthcare workers and elderly people. In the meantime, Brazil, that's the second worst affected country in terms of fatalities, also reported a daily record of more than 70,000 cases. Well, that brings the country's confirmed cases to 7 million with 182,000 deaths. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The coronavirus pandemic is a direct consequence of the imperative for growth at all costs, especially through extractive wealth concentrating capitalism and at the expense of the environment. This should make us all think whether any of us have spent enough time interpreting the world around us and whether our actions have been preceded by thoughtful consideration and debate. The recent U.S. presidential election, in which, as the U.S. media projected, the isolationist America First candidate experienced a crushing defeat, signaled a growing consensus that this unprecedented global emergency requires a global solution. If this is indeed the case, then philosophy can contribute in a great way to the resolution of this crisis. After all, unlike experts who often have a narrow focus and offer localized solutions, philosophy always aspires to address problems from a global perspective. Many renowned philosophers have written about the pandemic and the lessons all peoples of the world could learn from it. But there are some thinkers whose global perspective can especially help stem our obsession to change the world without taking the time to interpret it first. Stay with us for an article in this regard written by Santiago Zavala, a research professor of philosophy at the Pompeu Fabra University in Barcelona, Spain, under the heading, How Have Philosophers Responded to Pandemic? This article was published on aljazeera.com. Please stay with us to hear more about this issue. In her message to mark World Philosophy Day 2020, UNESCO Director General Audrey Azoulay underlined the exceptional nature of this year's celebration. She said this day is particularly meaningful this year, adding, it gives us the opportunity to celebrate much more than an academic discipline or a human science, but a certain way of being in the world made all the more necessary by the context in which we live today. Of course, the context Azoulay was referring to is the coronavirus pandemic that has touched every aspect of our lives. Indeed, from Barcelona to Baghdad, COVID-19 has radically altered the daily routines of everyone, that is, their being in the world. Unlike the suspicious September 11 attacks and 2008 financial crisis, the first two supposedly global events of 21st century, this pandemic has not spared anyone anywhere, and its consequences will continue to be felt for decades in every corner of the world. The global nature of this emergency has compelled everyone to contribute to the efforts to end it either professionally or in a personal capacity. While immunologists, doctors, and nurses become indispensable in the quest to develop vaccines and assist patients, others contributed simply by wearing masks and offering to help their vulnerable neighbors during lockdowns. But how have philosophers contributed? Can the love for wisdom, as it is classically defined, make any difference in a pandemic? The pandemic is a direct consequence of the imperative for growth at all costs, especially through extractive wealth concentrating capitalism and at the expense of the environment. This should make us all think whether any of us have spent enough time interpreting the world around us and whether our actions have been preceded by thoughtful consideration and debate. The recent U.S. presidential election, in which, as the U.S. media projected, the isolationist America First candidate experienced a crushing defeat, signaled a growing consensus that this unprecedented global emergency requires a global solution. If this is indeed the case, then philosophy can contribute in a great way to the resolution of this crisis. After all, unlike experts who often have a narrow focus and offer localized solutions, philosophy always aspires to address problems from a global perspective. Many renowned philosophers such as Judith Butler, Achille Mbembe, and Giorgio Agamben have written about the pandemic and the lessons all peoples of the world could learn from it. But there are two thinkers whose global perspective can especially help stem our obsession to change the world without taking the time to interpret it first. Slavoj Žižek and Bruno Latour. Žižek and Latour do not necessarily agree on how we can overcome this pandemic, but they both offer new ideas and questions that might at least prepare us for the next global emergency. Žižek asserts that the way we deal with this pandemic ultimately depends on our basic stance toward human life. This is why he believes this emergency, more than it has changed the world, has brought us to the fore those issues, such as extreme inequality, the commodified digitization of our lives, and institutional disregard for the environment, that war raging beneath the surface all along. The fact that there are billions of people, from refugees to those trapped in extreme poverty or in war zones, for whom COVID-19 is a comparatively minor issue, is an indication that we are not all in the same boat as many suggest. This is also evident for those who cannot work from home in safe isolation and must instead spend their day working in supermarkets, distribution depots, factories, and on the streets, protected only by whatever safety measures their employers care to offer them. In order for some to survive in their private quarantine, Žižek explains, many have to risk their lives for nothing more than the smooth functioning of the world capitalist market. According to the Slovenian thinker, the pandemic not only reveals these devastating consequences of capitalism, but also presents an opportunity for the reinvention of new strategies. He's not talking about a possible rebirth of the old style strategies, but rather a reorganization of global economy, which will no longer be at the mercy of market mechanisms. Alongside the viral pandemic, Žižek calls also for a confrontation with the pandemic of inequality and ecological degradation, a reconsideration of our entire stance towards life and nature. This reconsideration is also at the center of Bruno Latour's response to the pandemic. The renowned French philosopher of science suggests that the coronavirus emergency should be understood as a dress rehearsal for the ongoing ecological crisis. He explains the coronavirus epidemic is not simply a standalone health crisis, but part of a much bigger problem, a moment within the ongoing global ecological annihilation. While it might be true that we have now acknowledged the need to fight this virus collectively, this acknowledgement did not expand to the ongoing ecological crisis, as not many have drawn the connection between the continued degradation of the environment and the outbreak of this sickness. According to the French thinker, the pandemic calls for a new definition of society that is not limited to humans among themselves, but also includes other actors who do not have human forms, such as microbes, the internet, the law, the organization of hospitals, the logistics of the state, as well as the climate. Latour believes when this pandemic is over, it will be our obligation to demand from politicians that economic recovery does not bring back the climate policies that created this condition in the first place. The fact that we managed in a few weeks to put our economic system on hold everywhere is a demonstration that it is possible to instantly stop the so-called capitalist train of progress and create an alternative. As he recently said, If I could change one thing, it would be to get out of the system of production and instead build a political ecology. Both Zizek and Latour, as well as other philosophers who have publicly reflected on this pandemic, concur that this is the time to reconsider our way of being in the world. For too long, we have changed the world too rapidly without thinking carefully about the consequences. This is why both Zizek and Latour welcome the lockdowns that forced many into a kind of retreat to think, question, and imagine new ways to create a better future. While Zizek's call for a reorganization of global economy and Latour's desire for political ecology might sound unrealistic even during this pandemic, even merely thinking about these ideas could exert enough pressure on us to reconsider our way of being in and interpreting the world. Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing National Birds, directed by German filmmaker Sonja Kennebec. And joining me in this episode are Mike McCahill, who is a film and television critic for The Guardian, The Telegraph, and many other outlets. And beside him, we have Dan Glazebrook, who's a journalist, political analyst, and author of the book Divide and Ruin, The West's Imperial Strategy in an Age of Crisis. Now, National Bird follows the harrowing journey of three U.S. military veteran whistleblowers determined to break the silence surrounding the U.S.'s secret drone war. Tortured by guilt for their participation in the killing of faceless so-called suspects abroad, and despite the threats of being prosecuted, these three veterans offer an unprecedented look inside this secret program to reveal the haunting costs of the US's global drone strikes.
You literally just kind of hover, and you would wait until he walked out to the field to meet with some friends for something, and you'd blow him up. Drop a Hellfire missile on. Maybe we kill our objective, maybe we kill the guy who we thought was our objective. We don't know.
When I first got into the military and I was thinking it was a force for good in the world, I thought I was going to be on the right side of history, and today I don't believe I was.
I still have a top secret clearance, so I have to be extraordinarily cautious about what I can and can't say on camera.
My job was to watch what's happening in the video, the drones, and identify everything.
Adolescent near the rear of the SUV.
That's deceptive. You get the opinion that you're at 10,000 feet, you see this photograph, you know what's going on. You don't know what's going on. You know what you see in two dimensions.
You see someone die because you said it was okay to kill them.
It's too easy. They just embolden commanders.
Thunder's in, but the party began.
Because there is no threat.
Oh, sweet target.
I mean, this could grow to get so out of control.
Somebody downstairs was knocking at the door, and immediately both people at the door shoved FBI badges in my face.
The Espionage Act is one of the most serious charges you can level against an American.
That I'm probably going to get indicted and I'm probably going to get charged.
I lost part of my humanity working in the drone program. It's a secret program. I can't just go telling the public what it is. What I can tell you is that to me, it's frightening.
First of all, welcome to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. Now, Sonia Kennebec, the director, she won an award for this documentary with the Nation Institute, and she said in her award acceptance speech that she initially set out to make this documentary solely just about drones and drone warfare, but then it developed into something much more than this. Of course, we learn of the stories of the three characters in the documentary, and she wanted to focus also on the consequences of whistleblowing and espionage and all these sorts of issues. And Mike, if I can start with you, what was your take on this documentary?
Well, you can always tell there's something in the air, both literally and figuratively in this case, when filmmakers start making films about the same kind of thing. So in recent years, we've had three or four movies on the subjects of drones. We've had this, we've had the documentary called Drone, which is a slightly more arty and abstract version of this story. But we've also had feature films like Good Kill with Ethan Hawke as a drone pilot, and Eye in the Sky, a British film with Alan Rickman and Helen Mirren. So there's clearly something going on that filmmakers, that they want to be a part of this conversation. I think part of the situation is that we are still all, we're all making our way through this moral maze at the moment. We're all dealing with the ramifications of drone technology. We're trying to figure out what the consequences are, the good points and the bad points. And I think filmmakers like Sonia Kennebec here, they all want to have a say in that conversation.
And of course, as you said, there's been a resurgence in this topic of drone warfare and the moral obstacles around it. And we've had, this documentary had Wim Wenders as the executive producer. Of course, he's a multi-winning, award-winning German filmmaker. How much impact do you think he had in this documentary?
Well, he's one executive producer, and he, you know, Wim Wenders in the past has had an interest in surveillance technology. He made a very interesting film at the end of the last century called The End of Violence, which is about surveillance technology in America as it was back then. And obviously things have moved on very rapidly from that. The other executive producer is Errol Morris, who is, you know, a revered documentarian, and has made things like The Fog of War in the past. So he himself is also very interested in this subject matter. So it obviously helps a young up-and-coming filmmaker when you can get two great filmmakers, two revered filmmakers within the industry, to put their names on the credit of the film. You know, it all ties in with some of the work they've done in the past.
And Dan, if I could turn to you now, what's your take on National Bird?
Well, I thought it was interesting, but to be honest, I find this quite often with films on this subject, the tendency to focus on the emotional turmoil of the operators and really the perpetrators, I find, to be honest, slightly distasteful, really, given that the primary victims, obviously, of drone warfare are the people getting blown up and getting their legs blown off and so on. And they do feature in the film, and they have quite an extended section in Afghanistan talking to the victims, but you never get the feeling that they get the same full kind of personhood ascribed to them by the filmmaker. You don't see this sort of, rich emotional life that's depicted of the operators and the perpetrators, and I feel like that's actually is playing into the hands of the dehumanization that allows things like the drone program to exist. Because yes, Afghans are in the film, but they're just as victims who you know kind of walk around and then get bombed. There's no real feel of what it's like for them, what their lives are like.
I see your point, Dan, but one could argue that the role of whistleblowers and journalists, of course, shine a light on these issues, otherwise that would be ignored. And I think Sonia probably emphasizes this in the documentary.
Absolutely, and you know, that what they've done to come out against the program is commendable. But I think even to kind of do justice, if you like, to the operators depicted in the film themselves, you know, what turned them against what they're doing is that at some point they had a realization, my God, these are human beings that I'm killing. They're just like me or my mom or my neighbor. And I don't think that realization that's led to them being racked by guilt is fully given to us as a viewer. And I think that's problematic.
Well, that's a really interesting point. We'll have to pause there just for now.
I was an imagery analyst and a screener. My job was to watch what's happening in the video, the drones, the live video, of course, and identify everything. Another remote duty station, you'd have the pilot, of course, who's flying the actual aircraft, and the sensor operator who is moving the camera around. They were the ones that actually pushed the button. I do not push the button. I just identify what necessitates a button pushing. bomb someone and fly away. We have to follow through. The bomb hit and wait for it to cool down a little bit, and then you can see, like, the body parts. You can identify, like, that could be the lower half of his body, and that could be a leg. And then sometimes you'll stick around and watch family come and get them, or, like, pick up the parts and put their family member in a blanket. And a couple people hold onto a corner of the blanket and carry him back to their compound.
So it's Heather Leinberg. So you really feel for her in this documentary. Indeed, the other characters also, but she seems to come across as the one most plagued and crippled by guilt for her role in the drone program. Mike, what do you make of how her character is portrayed?
Well, she's not a million miles away from the Ethan Hawke character in Good Kill, the feature film that came out a couple of years ago, in that, you know, she was very much in the room watching this footage come in. And the sense that I got from her watching this film is that it's very different from being a soldier on the ground. If you're a soldier on the ground, you know pretty much that you've killed somebody if you haven't killed someone. The sense that I get from her, the issues that she's working through are connected to the fact that nobody has told her who she's killed, how many people she's killed. This is hanging over her, and you get a sense of this issue bearing down on her. It's like she's got something over her head, and that is a very powerful thing.
And Dan, I know you say the true victims are, of course, the targets of the drone strikes, but in this documentary, you see Heather and the others almost come across as victims in their own right, and perhaps particularly connected to the US military's recruitment campaigns. I mean, it's sold off, as you see, as a glorious sort of career you could have, and that you're on the right side of history and justice. I mean, what are your thoughts on this?
Oh, certainly, they are victims as well. They're secondary victims, I would say, but certainly, I mean, they're recruited into it pretty much as children, and to talk about the majority of drone operators being 18 to 24, so they're recruited at 18, practically children, but they'll be kind of groomed effectively from 16, 17. If you think about the involvement of the Pentagon with the video games industry, they're really being groomed from the age of whenever they start playing video games, 8, 7, 6, into this, into this role. So it's really, it is a form of institutional child abuse within America, you know, what America is doing to its own children, and here in this country in Britain as well, same thing. Certainly, and of course they're sold, as you say, the idea of being on the right side of history. One of the people involved in the program said,
"They have this real sense of moral righteousness, and that they set out to do the right thing.
Yeah.
They had good intentions at heart."
Exactly, but it's it is child abuse, and you see the impact, and the fact that they're not even allowed to talk to therapists because therapists don't have security clearance. So the other thing that they would want to discuss is classified, and so on. So absolutely, the treatment of them by the military is shocking. And you hear testimony from Heather in the film that her kind of commanding officers were constantly questioning her judgment. She was saying, "I think there's women and children here," and so on. And they're saying, "Are you sure? I don't think so. Let's fire anyway," and being overruled and so on. Absolutely, they are victims as well. I just don't think they're the primary victims.
A good point. And Mike, I just really quickly want to talk about the shots that are used in this documentary. We see a lot of aerial shots. And do you think the director did this intentionally to give the Western viewer the sense of what it's like to be watched? Because a lot of the shots are in US sort of suburban areas.
Yeah, I mean, the film sort of flips on its head halfway through, and we get a sense that the people who have been employed as watchers are now the watched. That is very much there in all those drone shots over American cities, American towns. Drones have revolutionized the way movies in general have been made, because now it's much cheaper to do aerial shots rather than hiring big bulky crane equipment. You can just fly a plane or fly a drone above people's heads. So that has changed as well, and I think that's one of the reasons why we're seeing so many films on this subject. The technology, the form and the content are married in this respect.
I think one of the strengths of the documentary is it shows how barbaric and brutal drone strikes are. And Mike, if I could ask you, what did you make of this journey to Afghanistan and this story?
I liked it very much. I mean, we see so many documentaries that set out their case in the first hour and then spend the second hour driving home the same points over and over again. Here, I think you get a sense of a story developing in real time. There was a sense that this technology has been thrust upon us, and like I said, we're all making and negotiating our way through this moral maze. And when it does finally get to Afghanistan, you get a sense there from that clip, the plane comes over, of just how normalized this kind of life has been. I mean, the fact it's called National Bird, would suggest that the drone has now become part of the natural order of things, part of the landscape for so many people, in ways both good and terrifying.
That's a really interesting point. And Dan, if I could turn to you, would you agree with what Mike just said? What did you make of the journey to Afghanistan in this documentary?
Well, I was glad they included it, because about 40 minutes into the film, I thought, are we going to hear anything from any Afghans whatsoever? And they did spend an extended period of time in Afghanistan. But as I said, I still didn't feel really they came across fully as agents. They were still depicted as, they were shown as suffering and as victims, but there's portrayed as only victims, just kind of passive recipients, really, of U.S. air power. There was no agency there, no narrative, no Afghan narrative was present, and there was no politics whatsoever in the film. And I think there's a real danger. The Glasgow Media Group carried a really interesting study out a few years ago on the Palestine-Israel conflict, and they found that a lot of journalists were quite sympathetic to the Palestinians, but they knew that they weren't really allowed in Western media to actually put forward a Palestinian narrative about resistance to occupation and so on. So instead of that, in place of that, they just paraded an endless parade of Palestinian suffering, but overlain with an Israeli narrative to justify it. Mm-hmm. And I think the danger by not giving any kind of Afghan narrative, we just see, we see the Afghan suffering, but there's no narrative, there's no other side of the story. The danger is that you have the same thing in the Palestine-Israel conflict, which people have pity for the Palestinians, but the overall view in the West, whenever Israel attacks, is, it's a sort of necessary evil in the war against terrorism. It's terribly sad, and we pity them, but it kind of has to be done. And I think there's a danger this film will have the same effect. People feel sorry for the Afghans, they'll pity them, but won't necessarily just see, it's a shame these innocent bystanders die and so on, but that's kind of necessary.
Mike, so would you have liked to see more political context to this documentary?
There's certainly scope for a more comprehensive and possibly slightly drier documentary about drone technology and the politics of deployment. I mean, this is not a film about the systemic application of drone technology. It's not about the technological specifics of it. It is a human story, and those are the documentaries that tend to get sold at international marketplaces, play at festivals these days, because they're very easy to relate to. I still think we're in the early days, the early days of this technology, and there will be a more comprehensive documentary than the ones that we've seen so far. But in terms of a primer of how this affects both the watched and the watchers, I thought it was pretty solid.
Mm. Well, thank you for that point.
This is global. This is getting information anywhere at any time, shooting people from anywhere at any time, and it's not just one person sitting there with a little remote control, a little joystick, moving around a plane that's halfway across the world. That's not all there is. It's like borders don't matter anymore, and there's a huge system that spans the globe that can just suck up endless amounts of your life, your personal data. I mean, this could grow to get so out of control. And we're not the only ones that have this. This is going to be commonplace, if it's not already. It's a secret program. And what that means is that I can't just go shouting off the hilltops telling the public what it is. What I can tell you is that to me, one person who worked within this massive thing, it's frightening.
So Mike, in the documentary we hear from President Obama give a televised speech talking about the drone warfare operation. And he says how it operates in such a way to ensure minimal loss of life and that they're precise and surgical strikes. Of course, in the documentary we learn that it isn't really that precise. And Daniel even says, one of the characters, that an element of guesswork is involved. Can you tell us more about this?
Yes, I mean, everyone does seem to be operating in some kind of gray area. I mean, we've seen from the clips that actually the images that the drones beam back to the operators in America are very fuzzy. I mean, there's a degree of ambiguity in those very images, never mind in the ethics of using this technology. And so what's interesting is what the film says about the way this technology has been sold to us. So it's clearly been sold to young army recruits as an exciting new development in the war on terror, and we've seen the adverts in the films that are all, they are like an advert for a computer game, as you say. But there's also a degree to which you think someone must have sold President Obama on this, that this is a new, clean way of killing, that you're killing, you're somehow keeping killing at arm's length, but you're still getting dirty hands. And I think this is something that all the people in the film are wrestling with.
Now, Dan, I think many people would be surprised to find that actually there were 10 times more strikes during President Obama's presidency than under George W. Bush's predecessor. What do you make of Obama's role in the drone warfare?
Well, on the one hand, drone warfare is a kind of terrifying, dystopian kind of future brought into the present. But at the same time, that shouldn't blind us to the fact that it's driven by desperation on the part of the Western powers. They tried big ground operations in Iraq and Afghanistan, and the fallout in terms of blood and treasure was so great that they just are not in a position to do that again. Mm-hmm. The Colin Powell said the US Army is just about broken by Iraq, so they don't have that option. So when you say, was Obama who sold Obama on this idea, well, the reality was he didn't, if he wanted to continue making war, and there's a whole systemic pressure to do so within the US government apparatus, then the former options have been ruled out. Mm. It's no longer feasible to have these mass ground scale operations.
Like in the Vietnam War, over 50,000 US personnel died.
Right.
And this was one of the factors that led to the pressure of the government to pull out.
Yeah.
But do you think if they had drones at the time that they would just have an endless war?
Well, it's an interesting question, isn't it? And quite feasibly, yeah. Because it was the body bag coming home from Vietnam that drove the pressure to end the war. You're right. With mm-hmm. drones, there's no US body bags. There's only Afghan body bags. Mm-hmm. And then there's obviously mental health fallout. Well, it's interesting that US casualties do exist. Heather talked about three of her friends on the drone program committing suicide. Mm-hmm. But of course, that doesn't have to generate the same headlines as a coffin coming home draped in a flag.
Mm-hmm. And a final say to you, Mike, would you recommend this documentary?
I think it's certainly worth watching. I think, this is one of those technologies that is that has proliferated very quickly. And like I say, we're all still wrestling with the ramifications of it, the consequences of it. It's not a bad place to start. I still think there'll be a more comprehensive documentary some years down the line.
Well, thank you very much, gentlemen, for your insights. And that's all the time we have for this episode of Duck Review. And thank you again to both my guests and to you. I've been Camilla Shambayati, and see you on the next episode of Duck Review.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.